said one of his mates. Why the hell'd you have to play so damn loud? Before George could say anything, Ripley replied, Gee, I'm sorry about that. Maybe next time I'll use a mute. The complainer walked down the bar toward Ripley. Next time, my ass. What are you going to do about the freaking headache you've given me? He was a tall, rangy sort, athletically built, short blonde hair with a funny little tail in the back, like an old-time matador. He was young, George saw, but old enough to have better manners. The Ripper's smile started to look a little forced. Very gently, he replied, I guess I could treat you to a couple of aspirins.
Fuck you and your aspirins!
The guy threw his drink into the Ripper's face. Ripley looked shocked, totally at a loss. He blinked in confusion as beer dripped from his nose, his ears. George stepped between them.
That wasn't very smart, he said. I'm not talking to you, Red. It's this wise-ass noisemaker I'm talking to.
He's my friend, said George. I think you owe him an apology.
And I think you ought to pull your shaggy ass out of this before you get hurt, said the Yobo.
And his three companions came up to stand with him. George smiled pleasantly. This was getting interesting, he thought. To the beer thrower, he said,
Mr. Ripley isn't the sort to get involved in a barroom brawl. He might hurt his lip, you see. And then everyone here would be upset with the people who made that happen.
The guy looked around. The pub was almost empty now. The few remaining regulars had backed away from the bar, drinks in their hands. A handful of others who had been leaving now stood at the doorway, watching. The barkeep had faded back to the other end of the bar, the expression on his face somewhere between nervous and curious.
I don't give a fuck who gets upset with who, and that includes you, big ass.
George grabbed the guy by the front of his shirt and lifted him, one hand, off the floor to deposit him with a thump on the bar. He looked very surprised. His three friends stood stock still. Ripley touched George's other arm. Come on, pal. Let's not have a fight. George looked from the Yabo sitting on the bar to his three standing partners, then broke into a shaggy grin.
Yeah, he said to the Ripper. No sense breaking the furniture or any heads.
He turned and started for the door. As he knew they would, all four of them leaped at him, and none of them knew beans about fighting in low gravity. George swung around and caught the first one with a backhand swat that sent him sprawling. The next two tried to pin his arms, but George threw them off. The original troublemaker came at him with a high-pitched yowl and a karate kick aimed at his face. George caught his foot in mid-kick and swung him around like a kid's toy, lifted him totally off his feet, and then tossed him flying into a howling, slow-motion spin over the bar. He crashed into the decorative glassware on the shelves along the back wall.
God damn it, George, that costs money, the barkeep yelled.
But George was busy with the three recovered yobos. They rushed him all at once, but it was like trying to bring down a statue. George staggered back a step, grunting, then smashed one to the floor with a single sledgehammer blow between his shoulder blades. He peeled the other two off and held them up off the floor by the scruffs of their necks, shook them the way a terrier shakes a rat, then banged their heads together with a sound like a melon hitting the pavement after a long drop. He looked around. Two men were unconscious at his feet, a third moaning face down on the floor. The barkeep was bending over the elbow on the floor behind the bar, amid the shattered glassware, shouting,
Well, somebody's got to pay for this damage.
Are you all right, George? Ripley asked. George saw that the Ripper had a packing crate chair in his hands. He laughed.
What are you going to do with that? Post him back to Earth?
Ripley broke into a relieved laugh, and the two men left the pub. Half a minute later, the Ripper ran back in and retrieved his trumpet. The bartender was on the phone, calling Chris Cardenas, the only qualified medical help on Ceres. He held a credit chip from one of the oboes in his hand.
Even after 5 years on Astro Corporation's board of directors, Poncho Lane still thought of herself as a neophyte. You got a lot to learn, girl, she told herself almost daily. Yet, she had formed a few working habits, a small set of rules for herself. She spent as little time in Astro's corporate offices as possible. Whether at La Guaira on Earth or in Selene, Poncho chose to be among the engineers and astronauts, rather than closeting herself with the suits. She had come up through the ranks, a former astronaut herself, and she had no intention of reading reports and studying graphs when she could be out among the workers, getting her hands dirty. She preferred the smell of machine oil and honest sweat to the quiet tensions and power jockeying of the corporate offices. One of her self-imposed rules was to make decisions as soon as she had the necessary information, and then to act on her decisions quickly. Another was to deliver bad news herself, instead of detailing some flunky to handle the chore. Still, she hesitated to put in the call to Lars Fuchs. It won't make him happy, she knew. Instead, she called his wife. Pancho and Amanda had worked together 5 years earlier. They had co-piloted Star Power One's maiden mission to the belt. They had watched helplessly as Dan Randolph died of radiation poisoning, murdered by remote control by Martin Humphreys. And now the Humper was offering to buy out Lars and Mandy, get them off Ceres, establish his own Humphreys Space Systems as the sole supplier for the rock rats out there. Pancho had tried to fight Humphreys, tried to keep Astro in the competition through Fuchs's little company, but she had been thoroughly outmaneuvered by Humphreys, and she knew it. Angry more at herself than anyone else, she marched herself to her office in La Guaira and made the call to Amanda. She paid no attention to the lovely tropical scenery outside her office window. The green, cloud-topped mountains and gently surging sea held no attraction for her. Planting her booted feet on her desktop, wishing there was some way to help Mandy and Lars, she commanded her phone to send a message to Amanda Cunningham Fuchs on Ceres. "Mandy," she began unceremoniously, "'fraid I got some bad news for you and Lars. Astro won't top Humphrey's buyout offer. The board wouldn't vote to buy you out. Humphreys has a nice little clique on the board, and they voted the whole proposition down the toilet. Sorry, kid. Look me up when you get back to Cellini or wherever you're going. Maybe we can spend some time together without worrying about business. See ya." Pancho was startled when she realized she'd been sitting at her desk for nearly half an hour without instructing the phone to transmit her message. Finally, she said, "Oh, shit. Send it."
The headquarters of the International Astronautical Authority were still in Zurich, officially, but its main working offices were in St. Petersburg. The global warming that had melted most of the glaciers in Switzerland and turned the snow packs of the alpine peaks into disastrous, murderous floods had forced the move. The administrators and lawyers who had been transferred to Russia complained, with some resentment, that they had been pushed off the greenhouse cliff. To their surprise, St. Petersburg was a beautiful cosmopolitan city, not at all the dour, gray, urban blight they had expected. The greenhouse warming had been kind to St. Petersburg. Winters were nowhere near as long and bitter as they had once been. Snow did not start to fall until well into December, and it was usually gone by April. Russian engineers had doggedly built a series of weirs and breakwaters across the Gulf of Finland and the Neva River to hold back the rising seas. Even though the late winter sunlight had to struggle through a slate-gray layer of clouds, Eric Czar could see from his office window that most of the snow had already melted from the rooftops. It promised to be a good day and a good weekend. Czar leaned back in his desk chair, clasped his hands behind his head, looked out across the rooftops toward the shimmering harbor, and thought that, with luck, he could get away by lunchtime and spend the weekend with his family in Krakow. He was not happy, therefore, when Francesco Tomaselli stepped through his office door with a troubled expression on his swarthy face. "Strange," Czar said to himself. "Italians are supposed to be sunny and cheerful people." Tomaselli always looked like the crack of doom. He was as lean as a strand of spaghetti, the nervous sort. Czar felt like Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. "Let me have men about me that are fat, sleek-headed men, and such as sleep o' nights." "What's the matter, Franco?" Czar asked, hoping it wasn't serious enough to interfere with his travel plans. Tomaselli plopped into the upholstered chair in front of the desk and sighed heavily. "Another prospecting ship is missing." Czar sighed, too. He spoke to his desktop screen, and the computer swiftly showed the latest report from the belt. A spacecraft named Star of the East had disappeared. Its tracking beacon had winked off. All telemetry from the craft had ceased. "That's the third one this month," Tomaselli said, his lean face furrowed with worry. Spreading his hands placatingly, Czar said, "They're out on the edge of nowhere, sailing alone through the belt. Once a ship gets into trouble, there's no one near enough to help.
What do you expect?